As you know, I have long believed that our original military involvement in Vietnam was rash and ill-considered, a product of what Senator Fulbright has since described as the arrogance of power. And I continue to believe that the escalation of our military involvement and its continuous is a result of the classic sin of pride. The greatest, most powerful nation on earth would simply not admit that it has miscalculated, and that in fact it has been forced to retreat on and retrench its commitments by a group of ragtag Asian irregulars and by a second-rate Southeast Asian power. I continue to believe that our involvement was and remains ill-considered, because I have never understood, nor has it been ever made clear by anyone, that vital national interests depend upon Generals Chu and Ki remaining in power in Saigon. The Saigon government is, in the first instance, a group of North Vietnamese expatriates who fled south in the early 1950s because they had been those who had collaborated with the French, who had worked against their own countrymen, and who could not stay with them. South Vietnam was not and is not a democracy. The generals have never been popularly elected in a truly free plebiscite. South Vietnam has yet to undertake that vote on unification, which was a provision of the 1954 Geneva Accord. And woe betide the candidate who was rash enough seriously to challenge the Saigon junta in one of the periodic show elections which have taken place. They've usually ended in jail, and those newspapers which were brash enough to support them have had their printing presses broken up and their editors join their candidates in jail. I cannot see how the defense of South Vietnam represents an important element in the defense of the free world or in the defense of the United States. South Vietnam is not a free nation. It never has been. The argument that we went into South Vietnam to prevent the incursion of the Chinese throughout Southeast Asia was, in its when it was first spoken, and remains to today, an argument which is solipsistic. An argument which simply leads us in circles. Because the North Vietnamese, quite as much as the South Vietnamese, do not want Chinese hegemony. To this very day, the North Vietnamese on their northern, on the Chinese border, maintain outposts to prevent the infiltration of Chinese volunteers. And throughout the long and, for North Vietnam, difficult days of the war, they never once requested military aid, that is, armed forces personnel, from the Chinese. The Thai, the Burmese, the Vietnamese, the Laotian, the Cambodians know from centuries of experience just how tender and gentle the mercies of the Chinese are. And in terms of preventing Chinese hegemony of the Southeast Asian peninsula, I would submit that our involvement in South Vietnam has been counterproductive. Indeed, it has made North Vietnam and other nations there depend more and more on China, far more than they would have normally wished. Why are we in South Vietnam? We're in South Vietnam because of bad chance and bad advice. Early on in the 1950s, there were some men in the State Department and the academic community who argued that one way or another we ought to pick up the broken French commitment to the defense of Southeast Asia. And these men saw in General Diem, you will recall, the very, very model of a benevolent Asian Mandarin who would somehow direct, lead his people into the 20th century and towards the West. And so he gave some money to support General Diem's benevolent dictatorship, and he gave some arms to support his police force, presumably to protect the integrity of the nation, actually to protect Diem from his own nation. A few dollars became a few tanks became a few cannon. A few cannon required the presence of American instructors. A few instructors required the presence of a Marine brigade. A Marine brigade required the presence of 500,000 American troops. The first few dollars we spent ended up costing us treasure in the excess of two hundreds of billions of dollars. At every step of the way, at every stage, there were those who advised, pull out. You made a bad commitment of men and of materiel. Withdraw. You miscalculated. At every step of the way, there were those who promised a quick and easy solution. And there were those who said that the American honor was at stake. We would lose face. Do you remember during the Second World War how we laughed up our sleeve because Orientals were so concerned about losing face? But our government has argued that we would have lost face if we had pulled out of Vietnam. And so we poured good money after bad, unbroken, whole young men after those who had already died. And the results have been clear for all to see. About 2 years ago, the American people became fed up with the war. Its magnitude, the casualties, became clear to all. The stock of President Johnson plummeted. He was forced to announce, you recall, that he would not seek re-election. He could not have been re-elected on the war issue. President Nixon was elected because he promised to lead the American people to peace, and largely because the American people remembered that his Republican predecessor, General Eisenhower, had promised new initiatives for peace and had, in fact, won peace in Korea. Yet here we are, 10 months after an administration enters power, promising to use all of its vigor in the pursuit of peace. Here we are with the issue of the war having surfaced again, in the midst of the second weekend of a national moratorium against the war. In that strange, anomalous position where the people want peace, and the administration claims it wants peace, and there is bitter division between them. In that strange and anomalous position where the administration has now openly admitted that all that the critics of the war said for all those long years is in fact true, that there are no vital national interests at stake in Vietnam. But what have we said? We have said we don't need bases and anchorage in this little Southeast Asian country. We have pledged that we are prepared to withdraw every one of our troops and every one of our planes and every one of our ships. And we have said that the free nations of the world do not require the maintenance in Saigon of the present government, that we would accept a popular front government, including the communists, if in fact they were democratically elected. We have said, in short, that the defense of this particular government and this particular small nation is not part of the grand, overall necessary scheme of American policy. That we have not gotten out, and the war continues, and the crescendo of the war these last several weeks seems to be mounting. Why so? On the one hand, there are those who say, get out now. And when they're asked, well, how does America get out? They answer very simply, by sea. And to the question, what will be the fate of the Saigon junta if we withdraw? They shrugged their shoulders. They really couldn't care less, even as the Saigon junta has had very little concern with the lives and the persons of those who opposed their regime. And there has been the administration pledged to seek peace, very much concerned not so much with the achieving of peace as with what it calls the winning of the peace. The phrase is President Nixon's. And what he seems to be to mean by the winning of the peace is this, that he believes that there are certain necessary prerequisites to our withdrawal. There are certain necessary preconditions to peace. And he has said in effect, and said it again in his November 3rd speech, that until these preconditions are achieved, Americans must be prepared to fight on and to make whatever national sacrifice is in fact necessary. And what are these preconditions? A mutual ceasefire under international supervision, a free election under an American umbrella or under international supervision, and a bilateral withdrawal both of the North Vietnamese forces and of American forces. President Nixon's position seems to be that unless we win what he calls peace with honor, a peace based on these preconditions, we will, in the first instance, expose our Vietnamese allies, and in the second instance, and certainly more importantly, in his view, we will have said that our pledged word throughout the world is not worthy of the paper on which it is set down, that no and none of our allies can depend upon the staunchness and the steadiness of the United States. The critical paragraph of his November 3rd speech read as follows. President Eisenhower and President Johnson expressed the same conclusion during their terms of office. For the future of peace, precipitate withdrawal would be a disaster of immense magnitude. A nation cannot remain great if it betrays its allies and lets down its friends. Our defeat and humiliation in South Vietnam, without question, would promote recklessness in the council of those great powers who have not yet abandoned the goal of world conquest. This would spark violence wherever our commitments help maintain the peace. In the Middle East, Berlin, eventually even in the Western Hemisphere. Ultimately, this would cost more lives. It would not bring peace. It would bring more war. I must respectfully disagree. It is a law in business. It's a law in politics. You only weaken yourself when you continue indefinitely an unprofitable venture. A nation is often much stronger for removing itself from age-old relationships which it can no longer sustain and maintain, and so it can concentrate on the new and critical undertakings of a new and different age. I give you as an example the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, you remember, backed down from its commitments in Cuba. Faced with the American threat of a nuclear war, the Russians backed down. They went back on their commitments. They went back on their pledged word. And are they weaker for it? No, they're the stronger for it. No one was prepared to challenge their takeover of Czechoslovakia. No one has been able to challenge their armament, the rearmament of the Middle Eastern powers of the Arab nation. No one is able to say to them, you are playing a fool's game in that part of the world. Russia has felt strong enough in the post-Cuba age to face China and to face her down over the Siberian borders. Russia, far from being weaker for her having backed down from certain commitments, is in fact stronger for it, and so would we be. Mr. Nixon, I submit, reads history incorrectly if he says, this would spark violence wherever our commitments help maintain the peace. In point of fact, it is our involvement in Vietnam which sparks violence wherever our commitments now seek to maintain the peace. But concentrated as we are with this foolish and stupid war, we have not the troops, nor the manpower, nor the wealth, nor the confidence in ourselves to respond to the threat of peace in the Middle East, to respond to the brush fires in Latin America and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. We are not the stronger for having been steady in foolish pursuit of our ambitions in Southeast Asia. Rather, I submit in all humility that we have been the weaker for them. I'm afraid that in his pursuit of what he has now called the policy of winning the peace, Mr. Nixon has continued along the line of his predecessors and leads us down a road which can only involve us more and more in the morass, the mud, the jungle, and the death and defeat in Vietnam. He has said that if negotiations cannot win the preconditions which he has set, he has another policy, one which is guaranteed to win out. He will Vietnamize the war, by which he means that he will encourage and succeed in having the Saigon government's army take over the war and do the fighting for us. The promise seems to be that America is only to spend its gold, and we can hire the soldiers, the mercenaries, the Asians who will do our fighting for us. We've had other such promises during the 8 years of the war in Vietnam, carrots at the end of the stick, and none of them have worked. You remember when our troops were coming home for Christmas of 1966? Vietnamization of the war. It's an incredible, incredible policy. The desertion rate of the South Vietnamese Army today is 30% of its effective forces every 6 months. Corruption is endemic. It still remains to be seen whether they can fight even a limited engagement under their own officers, with their own men, and fight it successfully. I'm afraid that if we give credence to this promise of Vietnamizing the war, we may for a time reduce our own losses, our own casualty lists. But we'll be pouring gold into a fight which will be frustrating and futile. And that ultimately there will be those who said, but they can't do it. We've got so much invested now. We can't possibly pull back. We can't possibly withdraw. And we will reverse the present policy of little by little removing our combat troops from Vietnam. As the rate of frustration grows in the nation, the appeal of the councils of the extreme right and of the extreme left gain in appeal. Just a few weeks ago, you remember, Senator Goldwater was again throwing the bombers and the nuclear bombs across the demilitarized zone, speaking of bombing the dikes of the Red River and flooding the green lands of North Vietnam. These voices are again being heard in the land because they are the ultimate result of months and months, which certainly lie ahead if this remains our policy, of frustration, of ongoing conflict, of ongoing loss of life, loss of money. In pursuit of national unity, behind this program of winning the peace, President Nixon and the administration in the last weeks has set in motion a gigantic propaganda and public relations effort, which in the short term has certainly been successful. Shortly following the speech of November 3rd, which was ballyhooed, you'll remember, for weeks, there appeared the very next morning, as a matter of fact, in the major newspapers across the land, full-page advertisements. "We back you, Mr. President," signed by the citizens concerned for peace with honor. And the Armistice Day, Veterans Day last week, was used by all kinds of, in quotation marks, patriotic organizations, as though all American organizations are not patriotic, in order to preach sermons at Arlington Cemetery and elsewhere, that these were the men who were unabashedly patriotic, the assumption that others were not, who backed the president because America would not be defeated, that America would not be humiliated, that we would find peace, in fact, with honor. Secretary of Transport, John Volpe, the Vice President, Mr. Agnew, have been the men whom the administration has let loose to speak what others are thinking, the unspoken thoughts. The Vice President has spoken of the dissenters as a strident minority, of dissent as a carnival in the streets, negative in content, disruptive in effect, intolerant clamor, simple cacophony, nothing more. We've been taught to look upon the demonstration this last weekend in Washington as that of kooks and kids, of a dissident fringe who need not be listened to, of a minority who express a point of view which is fundamentally unpatriotic, unacceptable. Mr. Nixon gave the key in this address on November 3rd. He spoke a sentence that really no American president ought ever to speak. He said then, the North Vietnamese cannot humiliate or defeat the United States. Only Americans can. And the assumption was, and Mr. Agnew has made it clear, that those who would humiliate and defeat the United States are those who protest. Those who do not believe that the enunciated policy is an acceptable one, a feasible one, who believe rather that it is feckless and disastrous, and that they speak as they do not because they love America more, but because they love some other power or some other ideology the more. I look to the president, I must confess, for leadership in these last months. I've been disappointed. Leadership implies reconciling a nation, not dividing it. How wonderful it would have been in October if during that first moratorium, the president, as the president of a nation dedicated to peace, had left his White House and gone to one of the many services in Washington dedicated to peace. What would he have lost? Honor? Self-respect? He would have said, I'm one with you. Our disagreement is one of technique, one of strategy, not one of basic philosophy. But he has walled himself in the White House as if he were besieged in some armed camp. For blocks yesterday, no one could approach the White House. He sat there, not as the president of the American people, but as the leader of only those of the American people who would say, yes, we follow you. An unmistakable message went out from the White House this past week through the vice president again. This administration expects that on major issues, the mass media, particularly in this case the television, will use its powers to promote the presidential policy, whatever their opinion may be about that policy. I'm afraid that not only is the president's policy of winning the peace in Vietnam, one difficult to achieve, but in the United States, is drawing to himself of the mantle of patriotism, is pointing the finger of those who disagree, this intemperance and impatience with those who allow other voices to be raised and heard in the land. But this kind of policy is ultimately one which will sap the very vitals of the American system and may launch on this country of ours another period such as we had in the early 1950s with Senator McCarthy. What lies ahead? The president has won to himself the silent majority he spoke about the other night. For the moment, most people seem prepared to go along with the president, to give him another chance. He spoke in terms of peace. They believe that within his terms, peace can be achieved. I do not believe it, but many do. Standing in the Gallup polls rose after this speech of November 3rd. Well and good. But how long will the great silent majority agree to give the president his time? Will they agree when the tax rate rises again in order to pay for the cost of the war? How long will they agree when the casualty lists mount back to their level of 300 to 400 or 500 a week? How long will they agree if we are forced to reverse our present policy of a timetable withdrawal from Vietnam and must, instead of withdrawing manpower, add manpower to that which has already been committed? If the president does not, in fact, in short order, succeed in bringing off his policy of winning the peace, the great silent majority will slip away from him, as it slipped away from President Johnson 2 years ago. Because of this, I am fundamentally and firmly convinced that whether we agree with the president's policy or disagree with it, most Americans, want peace. Not the escalation of the war, but the end of the war. Peace with honor, if we can gain it, but peace nonetheless. The president, it seems to me, and the administration in the days ahead has a terrible burden resting upon it. Power, authority always does. The president has the responsibility of maintaining the integrity of our national policy, the integrity of our body politic. We are one nation, and certainly in the great middle of the nation, the vast majority of the people, except those committed to extreme ideologies at the two ends of the hemicycle of our population, certainly he must bind the wounds. He must make all of us sense that we are walking down a path we share and in which we believe. He has instead, I'm afraid, become divisive. Taken to himself those who will agree, pushed away those who disagree. But having said this, I must add that among those who dissent, and in the dissent itself, there have been those who must equally share a responsibility for the growing rifts within our nation. What kind of business is it to wave a Viet Cong flag at a demonstration for peace? Are the Viet Cong peaceful people? Are the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong the great proponents of peace in our world? Is it not true that if they would simply negotiate at Paris, they would win all that they want and more in short order? A few concessions? Another year or two of dealing with a paperboard government in Saigon, it would quickly be overthrown. The Viet Cong and the Vietnamese have only to say now, we will negotiate. Take America at its word. And I'm convinced that America would withdraw its troops and that the Southeast Asian labyrinthine policies would quickly make it possible for the Vietnamese of the North to achieve whatever their goals are in the South. But they will not negotiate. How then can they be called the proponents of peace? What kind of business is it really to see, as some of the speakers on the platforms of the peaceniks have said, to see all the evil in the world, all the violence in the world is resting upon the malignity of the military-industrial complex in our nation, or the ambitions of our military to have another row of ribbons on their chest, to have a few thousand more men under their command? We do not maintain an armed force simply because there are those in the nation who would like to flaunt American power. There are, of course. But ultimately, we maintain our armed force because there are many nations through the world which flaunt their power. What is Russia doing in the Middle East? What did China do in Tibet? The nations of the world, all the nations of the world, truly wanted peace. Then the kinds of negotiations which we are beginning in Helsinki this week, arms control, disarmament, might have, in fact, some chance of success. But in point of fact, our enemies are implacable and military, and ultimately to defend the freedoms which we cherish, we must be, to a certain degree, implacable and military. Disarmament, total unilateral disarmament, pacifism, the philosophy of total surrender of all that we have, lo zu haderech. This is not the way. We'll only whet the appetites those who sense that their prey is blooded, wounded, and weakened. The American people face an uncertain future. None of us likes to look squarely at the possibility of war, especially of a nuclear war. But the President is certainly right that there are commitments which we must meet. There are allies whom we must support and sustain. There are chances which we must take. And that there are times when we must call upon our young men and upon ourselves to risk our bodies in the defense of freedom. Freedom has always required defense, no less in history than now, no less now than in the past. But having said all of that, the burden of proof, I submit, rests upon the administration. There is the power. It is there that policy is made. Ultimately, how the administration works out its search to win the peace, how it handles the dissent, honest dissent, how it deals with the American people openly in terms of reconciliation, in terms of shared commitment, or arbitrarily, angrily, little men demanding obedience, that decision ultimately will spell, for better or for worse, our future. The President has awesome power. The President, in my humble opinion, is abusing that power. I pray that we will find the peace, even if we do not win it. But most of all, I pray that in finding the peace, we will not destroy what little peace remains in this great nation of ours. We will not set the youth against the establishment. We will not set the administration against the people. We will not let loose the hounds of those who bray for any who will not salute instantly and order be given. We're entering a very difficult period. We need leadership in that period. We need moderation and understanding. We need it. The administration needs it. God knows the world needs it. Amen.